Right, so here we are looking at the beginning of the third chapter in Brachot. So we began quite a while ago. This Talmud Torah approach to studying Talmud. We've learned through two selections from two chapters, and now we're moving into the third chapter. And as it says over here, this session concerns honor due to the dead, someone who's passed away, honor due to a Torah scroll, and if we get that far, the question whether or not the dead hear what people are saying and know what is taking place in this world. So we start with the, so this is. Let's just get the right page. It is 17b, Yud Zayin, Daf Yud Zayin Amud Bet, 17b in Brachot, and the Mishnah says, "Mi shemeto mutar lefanav." Someone whose deceased relative is there in front of him. Patur mikriyat Shema, he is not liable to say the Shema, uminatfila, or the Amidah, uminatfilin, and he shouldn't put on tfilin. Umikol mitzvot ha'amurot la'Torah, and all the mitzvot which are there in the Torah. That means everything that he's supposed to do, a positive action of some kind, he can't do it because his close relative, that is a parent, a sister, God forbid, a child, brother, this close circle of relatives, they have a special relationship with the person, and he cannot pray, as we've just seen, he can't say the Shema. He's called an onen. At this moment, he's called an onen, that's someone who has a departed close relative, and that departed close relative has not yet been buried. And so, as we'll see a bit later in the sort of, as this unfurls, we'll hopefully see what it says in the Babylonian Talmud, what it says in the Jerusalem Talmud a bit. So as it unfurls, we'll see that this onen, this person who his close relative has, God forbid, passed away, he's supposed to be totally focused on that. That is the kavod hamet. That's the honor of the dead person. And so that honor to the dead person supersedes everything else. So, and it should not look as if he's sort of not thinking about him at this minute. It's he's there focused. Now, so here we have a kind of little presentation about this. Would anyone like to read it? Tim, would you like to read it?
I can read. The person whose close relative is deceased and he has the responsibility to bury that person is halachically in a state of one who is active in the mitzvah that is not obligated by another.
Right. He's active in one mitzvah, which is caring for the dead. So he's not obligated by any other mitzvah, such as saying the Shema or praying. Can you go on? This is a principle.
This is a principle applied in various ways in Jewish law. It originates in the first chapter of this tractate, Brachos 11a, discussing what is meant in the Shema when it says you should say the daily, excuse me, you should say the daily Shema when you sit in your house, when you walk on the way. Excuse me, summarizing, this is explained as follows. When you sit in your house and are not performing another mitzvah, when you walk on your way, not on a way which is specific mitzvah, then you must say the Shema at the right time. But if you are involved in another mitzvah, you do not have to say the Shema. The mitzvah which the Talmud there discussed was its was its was which was is groom a groom on the way to the right to the night of the first marriage. I'm sorry, my screen isn't real clear.
Right.
A Hasidic way of
Wait,
understanding. Did you want me
okay,
to?
hold on. Let's stop there. Thanks very much. So we've got the idea. This is actually from this tractate earlier on in the first chapter, where it spoke about a groom on the first night of his marriage, and it learnt out from the verse that if you're sitting in your house, in other words, you are not performing a specific mitzvah, or you're walking on your way. That means just something which it is, you're free to do this or to do that. Then, when it comes to say the Shema, you have to say the Shema at the right time. But if you are deeply involved in some other mitzvah, now in the first chapter, it spoke about the mitzvah of a groom who has married a woman. And he is now focused on the whole question of the first night of marriage with this young lady or older lady. He is theoretically, he does not have to say the Shema. In fact, as we discussed at that time, nowadays we say people don't have such concentration on the Shema anyway, and so he might as well say the Shema. And the fact that he's anxious or whatever it might be about this first night with his new bride, he'll just have to take that in his stride. But we have this theoretical concept that if one is involved, and which in fact, ha'osek b'mitzvah, someone who's involved in one mitzvah, patur mi-mitzvah acheret, is not liable for another mitzvah. So that is something which does extend throughout the Talmud. And here in chapter 3, we meet this concept, even though it's not expressly stated in the wording, that a person who is busy, occupied, and preoccupied with the burial of a close relative, God forbid, since he is focused on that, he does not have to say the Shema or the prayer, the Amidah, the standing up 18 benedictions. He cannot make, and it's not just a voluntary thing. He doesn't have to say it. In fact, the sages say he mustn't say it. He mustn't say these prayers, and he can't even make a blessing. So if he's going to eat, have a drink, he just has to have the drink without making a blessing. So all these aspects of life, daily aspects of life, are suspended because he is an onen and he's focusing on the issue of the mitzvah to bury the dead. Now, here's another little discussion about this. Rabbi Lu, would you like to try this, a Hasidic way of understanding this?
Yeah, 1 second. Can you hear me?
Yeah, very well.
Okay. B, a Hasidic way of understanding this is that a mitzvah connects a person to Hashem. The word mitzvah is usually understood as coming from the verb tziva, command. A command connects the commander, God, and the commanded, the person. There's also another way of understanding the word mitzvah as coming from the Aramaic verb tzavta, which means connect. When carrying out a mitzvah, one is connected with Hashem in a very intense way, and therefore it is not appropriate to do anything else, even if that itself is a mitzvah.
Right, thank you. So that means that there's this very strong connection with the divine.
See,
Now then we have C. Let's just see if there's Avraham, would you like to read this at all? Number C.
Course, yes.
So
See,
another way.
another way to understand this halakha in the Talmud is that it concerns the honor of the dead, kavod ha-meis. Because of this focus on honor of the dead, the onan, meaning the mourner, before his dead close relative is buried, should not do anything else. His or her entire being should be focused on caring for the meis and making sure he or she gets buried properly. Both approaches, one who's occupied with a mitzvah is not obligated by another mitzvah, and the concern for honor of the dead raise the question of the difference between an onan who is directly involved with arranging the burial and one who is, for example, sitting at home waiting, for example, for the burial society to state what time the funeral will be. Or someone who is not a relative, but who is sitting with the dead person guarding the mace. The Talmud shortly discusses this question. The conclusion is that the exemption or prohibition from performing other mitzvahs, such as reading Shamar, applies to all close relatives, wherever they are. They all have the status of onan, and the person who is next to the meis, even though he is not a relative, is also exempt.
Right,
Right,
thank you
to
very
continue.
much. Okay, that's lovely. So we've got here this idea that there is the person who is actively involved in getting things organized about burying the person, which might mean rushing around, getting a death certificate, going to a coroner's office, doing this or that, in the UK environment, and presumably something similar in the United States and elsewhere. But even if one is not doing the running around, it might be someone else in the family or a different person or the Chevra Kadisha, the burial society, they've organized everything. And all the mourner, the onen, is doing is waiting for the phone call. Yes, we've organized the funeral for such and such a time. But nonetheless, he is still an onen. He is still has this focus on the honor of the dead. Now, all this, we're just looking at the Mishnah. We haven't yet entered the Talmudic discussion of the Mishnah. The Mishnah now continues concerning the bearers of the coffin or the corpse. Not always is there a coffin. In Britain, and I think in America, a coffin is used. In Jerusalem, they do not have a wooden coffin. And the corpse is wrapped in a shroud, in a kittel, but it's not in a wooden box. So it's called the bed. Nosei hamita, the carriers of the bier, B-I-E-R, the chilufeihen, and the other people who are going to take their turn, like they're taking it in turns. There's a group who are carrying the bier at this moment, and 5 minutes' time, that's going to change, and there are going to be some other people. And the next group as well. So you can have three groups. One group who's carrying it now, then another group, and then there'll be another group. Those who are in front of the bier, and who therefore have not yet carried it, the etchel achamita, and then you have those who are behind it. That means they had their turn already. So etchel ifnei, the ones who are in front and haven't yet had their turn, but they're going to get their turn, they are paturi. They do not have to say the Shema, or they cannot say the Shema. The etchel achamita, and those who are behind the mitzvah, but they are needed. They're still needed, but so they've had their turn, and so therefore they're not actually needed to the same extent. Chayavit, they have the duty to say the Shema. So in other words, when it comes to saying the Shema, it depends whether they are suddenly going to be needed for carrying the bier, the the mace, the dead person, or they've had their turn and they're not going to be needed necessarily. However, even though some of them should say the Shema, some of them don't have to, Elu ve'elu paturin min atfila, they can't suddenly stand there and say the 18 benedictions while the other group of people around them are carrying this deceased person to the cemetery, right? It might be quite a long way to go to get to the cemetery. They're walking, and it might be quite a way, but they can't suddenly in the middle start saying the Amidah unless, of course, they separate from the whole group. Now,
Is
so
that just a practical thing?
it looks like a practical thing. Yes. If we so if we see here is Rabbi Steinsaltz's elucidation. Those before the bier who are needed to carry it, they're exempt from reciting the Shema, and those after it, even if they still might be needed, but since they've already had their turn, they actually should say the Shema. But both of them do not say the Amidah since until they get to after the whole thing. They buried him, and then or her, and then they're able to pray with the proper concentration. Right now, the Mishnah deals with the row, the Shura. Today, the consolers form two lines, and the mourners pass between them. Now, this is what happens in most funerals, or certainly a Haredi-style funeral. The consolers form two lines, the mourners pass between them, and the consolers give them the blessing, Seder de Shiva. Hamakom Yenachem Etchem, God should comfort you together with the other mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. Now, something similar took place in the times of Mishnah, and that's what we're going to read about today. The Code of Law defines it as I've just read it, which is the current practice today. It was slightly different in the time of the Mishnah. Now, Kavru et ha-met, so they buried. So you had the pallbearers carrying the bier to the grave, and they buried him. Now that they've buried him, im yocholim lahatchil v'ligmor, if they're able to begin and finish saying the Shema, ad shelo yagia leshura, before they reach the row, these rows of people, they should do that. V'im lav, but if not, lo yatchilu, they shouldn't begin and they should wait. Hopefully, there'll be time later. Now, nowadays, everyone would have made sure generally to have said the Shema earlier, to have prayed earlier. They would have gone up early to pray, hopefully with the minyan. Here we're talking about the fact they hadn't said the Shema yet. What should they do? They're there caught up in a funeral, and the funeral is itself a very great mitzvah, even if it has nothing to do with one. It mentions later on if a funeral procession passes a person in the street, they're supposed to walk along a few steps with it. So it's something which is given great significance. And so this is not the moment to say the Shema unless they've just buried this person, and now it's a little bit of a walk to that part of the cemetery where they're making these shurot, this row. And there's enough time there. You can say the Shema while you're walking, except for the very first line. And so you say the first line, and then you walk along, and you're able to get through the three paragraphs of the Shema, which hopefully you know by heart, before you get to the rows. Now, then we have the actual picture of the rows, quite graphic. Ha'omdim bashura, those who are standing in the row, Hapnimiyim puturim, those who are on the inside of the row, that means they're closest to the mourners, they do not have to say the Shema. Bahachitzonim, but the ones on the outside of the row, chayavim, they have the duty. So someone is on the outer side of this row, And they suddenly realize, oh, I forgot to say the Shema this morning. He quickly says the Shema, even though he's in this crowd, this crowd of people, and beyond that crowd are the actual mourners.
Tully,
Now,
is it possible that they're bearing the mace very early in the day? And that's why these issues about Shema and Tefillah come up, whereas we're not used to it being quite so early in the morning.
that's a very interesting suggestion, which I don't remember, seeing that point made. It could be.
The person might have died in the night, and this, it might be beginning the burial before daylight even.
Okay. So it's certainly all possible. I mean, you could say, in a sense, that we live with sort of controlled cemeteries. The cemetery only opens at a certain time, and then it closes at a certain. There's a caretaker. There is the Chevra Kedisha, who is a special organization, and they are also operating at certain times. So so maybe it's in a more standardized way now. Whereas, as you suggest, it could have been very early in the morning, or as Rabbi Lu says, it could have been, later, so late at night that as you're burying the dead, you suddenly realize it's the time to say the Shema. That's now then it suddenly mentions Nashim va'avadim uktanim, women and slaves and children, p'torim mikriyat Shema min ha'tfilin, they do not have to say the Shema or put on tfilin, v'chayavim b'tfilah, but they do have the duty to say the Amidah, to say the main standing prayer, u'b'mezuzah, and they have to have mezuzah on their doors, u'b'birchat hamazon, and they have to say grace after meals. And it puts this here. Some editions of the Talmud have this line in brackets because it actually occurs in the next Mishnah and it's repeated there. I was wondering while I was thinking about this passage that certainly as regards to women, that the way in which women are carers. They care for their husbands, they care for their children, they care for people around them, that their quality as carers is kind of like the person who is like caring for the deceased relative. So when someone is in that state of being a carer in an intense way, then they do not have to say the Shema. Or other things. Now it's interesting that it says, but I haven't found a source for that. That it's just something that was kept occurring to me. Now they have the duty to pray, which is an interesting statement. This is a whole discussion in Halakha, and in fact in Hasidic thought as well. One view is that if a woman says Modeh ani, waking up in the morning, so I thank you, God, for returning my soul to me. In that, she has fulfilled the command from the Torah to pray. And other aspects of her of prayer are from the sages rather than from the Torah. However, that some people say a woman should try to pray. One prayer a day, one Amidah a day. Many women say both Shacharit and Mincha, and there are, maybe a minority who also say the evening prayer as well, which itself has an ambiguous quality. So that's its regard women. So now we have. A little bit more background to this row, right? The rows. And we are turning to another volume of the Talmud. This is still the Babylonian Talmud, but it's Sanhedrin 19a. Tanu Rabbanan, the sages learn. Barishona, at the beginning, Hayu Avelim Omdim, the mourners would stand, Vohola Omevrim, and the people, the consolers, would pass them by. Then came a major problem. There were two families, two prominent families in Jerusalem, who were arguing one with the other. Zod Omeret, one family said, Ani Overet Chila, I should be first. Zod Omeret, and the other family said, Ani Overet Chila, I should be first. Hitkinu Shehea Am Omdim, so they established that the people should stand still, so you won't get the idea of who's first and who's second. Va'avelim Ovrim, and it is the mourners who pass by the people. Now that's actually the way the shura is carried out, the row is carried out in a Haredi funeral, that the consolers, the other people who've come to the funeral, they stand in two lines and they're standing still. And the mourners walk in between them. So that gets over this problem, this mysterious problem here of these two families who were arguing because of that, because there was this original situation that the mourners stood still and everyone passed by them. Now, in fact, at a later stage, at the funeral, in most funerals, the mourners do sit down on a kind of low seating area in the hall of the cemetery, and everyone does pass by the mourners and wish them long life and so on. So it seems as if somehow both. Because the Talmud in Sanhedrin continues about this, that it then it was put back to its original way. But the way in which the later halachic sources put it is this system of the consolers standing still and the mourners passing in between them. Now, so that raises, that's quite a dramatic thing. Rosalind, it's nice seeing you here. Are you able to see where it says number A over here, hearing about the two families?
Second. Yes, I can.
Would you like to read it?
Yes, with pleasure. Hearing about the two families in Yerushalayim who would fight with each other reminds us that the cause of the destruction of the Second Temple was causeless hatred, as recounted in the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa in Gittin 55b. The Rebbe often said, hence the way to rebuild the temple is through causeless love, love of one's fellow Jew to a limitless degree. It is said about the great Hasidish Rabbi Mendel Futterfass that the chocolate, i.e. the luxuries, of another Jew meant more to him than his own, quote, salt herring, close quote, i.e. bare necessities.
Right, so he had a tremendously passionate love and concern for other people more than himself, and the very opposite of this behavior of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. I imagine people know the story that one of these was a friend, the other was an enemy, and by mistake an invitation to a feast went to the enemy instead of the friend, and when the host found him there, he wanted to throw him out, and the guest offered to pay for the food he had, or even pay for the half the banquet, or even the whole banquet, and the host insisted on throwing him out, and the Talmud presents this as a step in the whole process which led, unfortunately, to the destruction of the temple. So it's So this idea of two families in Jerusalem fighting together, who's going to be first in the row to console the mourners, rings that kind of bell. However, let's just have a look. The general concern So, Tim, would you like to come back on this? The general
Yes.
concept.
The general concern for the honor of the dead derives from concern for the soul and for the body. The Zohar states their bodies are holy, their souls are holy. The soul has three aspects: nefesh, ruach, and neshama. It is said that the nefesh remains with the corpse and later at the grave, while ruach and neshama ascend above. So concern for the honor of the dead is both a concern for the nefesh and for the physical body.
Right, so we've got this idea that there's the soul of the person, whatever aspect of soul, and also the physical body, as the Zohar says, their bodies are holy. Now, if we look at this next thing, C, Rabbi Lou, would you like to read this? The focus is on the body.
I got unmute. Okay.
Yeah.
See, but the focus is on the body. One second. Here. The focus is on the body. And in Tanya chapter 49, it speaks of Hashem choosing the body of the Jew. The choosing of the Jew, the chosen people is the body of the Jew. Because the soul is anyway exalted, while the body looks the same as anyone else's body. In other words, if you're choosing, it has to be two equals. The Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Rebbe, speaks of atzmut, the essence, being expressed in the body. Thus, it is said that while now the soul is higher than the body, when Mashiach comes, we will see the greatness of the body, and the body will give a spiritual input to the soul. Of course, when Mashiach comes, there is the concept of the revival of the dead, which also stresses the significance of the physical body. Hence, we can understand the way Jewish law and custom focus on the significance of the live body and the practical mitzvot it can achieve, and after death, on the significance of honor for the dead body and the process of burial.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, so now we've finished the Mishnah and we've now come to the Gemara discussing the Mishnah. And it begins discussing with the question of, is the corpse actually there in front of the person or not? So the Gemara says,
Sorry, can I ask a
Mudbar.
question about the kedusha of the body?
Yes.
Sorry, yeah, so from what Rabbi Lou just read, it seems like the holiness of the body is because of its because it's a vehicle for doing mitzvot. Is that right? Or is there some inherent kedusha for the body itself?
Yeah, I think from these Hasidic sources, it's the body itself has a deep spiritual quality. See, for the idea of being created by Tzelem Elokim in the image of God. Now, this is often spoken about in terms of the soul or in spiritual terms. But there is also the sense that the body itself has a tremendous degree of holiness, even in a sense beyond mitzvah. And so, for example, there's the question when it's the time of the revival of the dead, when pe will people keep the normal mitzvah? When it's the time of Mashiach, the earlier time, then, as the Rambam says, all the mitzvah will come into operation. And including, for example, the mitzvah concerning the temple and the sacrifices that we haven't been able to keep for 2,000 years. But then, when it comes to the revival of the dead, to what extent will these practical mitzvah be kept then? You know, so there's there are various phrases in the Talmud and elsewhere which suggest that they're not kept in that in that normal way. And there, the body itself will express the holiness, the spiritual holiness of the essence of the divine creating a physical person as the representative of the divine in this world. Rabbi Lu, would you like to add anything for Abraham?
It just put the same point, just in a slightly different way, because Avram mentioned, is it because of the body or because the body did the mitzvot? The fact that the body was chosen to do the mitzvot, that in itself is a cause or an expression of something special about the body, which is not dependent on the or proportional to how much of the mitzvahs the body did. The body is holy because that body was created to do mitzvahs by Hashem. So even the body of someone who, let's say, God forbid, didn't do mitzvot, there's tremendous efforts put into seeing they should come to Kever Yisrael, to Jewish burial, and not, God forbid, be cremated or some other way of dealing with the body.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.
May I ask, please?
Yes, Rivka.
Granting that there is Gilgul Neshamot, and what body we're talking about? The last body, the one before? So what body is concerned, please?
Yeah, that's a lovely question. Rabbi Lu, the question is, given that there's Gilgul Neshamot, I assume you're asking this, Rivka, which body is revived in Tchiyat HaMetim, in the revival of the dead? Is that what you're asking, Rivka?
But there's a study of the Rebbe from before his leadership in the early 40s, about maybe a 10-page essay on all aspects of Tchiyas HaMetim. Basically, by the way, it was translated. I don't know if it's still available in a book called "To Live and Live Again" by Rabbi Dubov, translated. And if I remember correctly, the Rebbe speaks about in those Gilgulim, there were different aspects of the neshama which motivated and which generated the fulfillment of mitzvot with that particular body, and that aspect of the neshama, and so all of those bodies could be revived. Each one being animated by that aspect of the neshama which generated the mitzvahs that it did.
Thank you.
And
Okay, Rivka.
I'm saying that it's many, many years since I saw this, but I'm almost sure that that's what it said.
Okay.
Hey, sorry, so how many bodies then there are? It just means there's multiple bodies in this case.
Could
There
well
were,
be.
yeah. Speak, Rabbi Tal.
Yeah, I think actually this was a discussion between the Rebbe and his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law was sitting Shiva, and the Rebbe spoke to him. It was Menachem Avril, if I remember rightly. Maybe I've got it wrong. And this they were discussing precisely this point. Am I remembering rightly, Rabbi Lu? The Rebbe and the Rashab, and
I understand. It's possible. I can look. I have here the Menachem
right.
Tzion. I have to check it out. But what I'm talking about was actually an answer to, there was a publication that came out, and they had questions and answers, and the Rebbe answered these very interesting questions. And this was, it ended up to be about an 8 or 9 page letter, which became like a little booklet, a whole kuntres. It's amazing. But that was before, when his brother-in-law sat Shiva. Let me just see. You might want to continue, and I'll just have a
Yeah,
look in here.
all right. So we'll continue with the Talmud. So here we've got the discussion in the Talmud. The Gemara says, Mutal lefanav. The whole thing that we're talking about here is that the deceased relative is lying in front of him. And then in that case, he said that he cannot say the Shema, and he cannot say the Amidah, and he cannot do this, and he cannot do that. So if the deceased relative is in front of him, in, yes, that's where everything we're saying applies. But if he's not in front of him, lo, you might say, perhaps, that if the dead person is not right there in the room in front of the mourner, the onen, then lo, then these things do not apply, and the onen, even though he's very upset, a very close relative passed away in another town or in another part of the town, and he is here, and the corpse, the met, is somewhere else. So maybe he should say the Shema and pray and put on tefillin and so on. So that's the question that so the Talmud is suggesting that if the dead person is here in front of him, then that's right, he doesn't say the Shema and so on. But if the dead person is not in front of him, then he is not exempt from the Shema, and he just has to be like a normal person. And now the Talmud presents a contrasting perspective. Very mini. And we contrast this with another statement by the sages. Misha metom mutal lefanav, someone whose close relative has passed away and is there in front of him, ochel bebayit acher, eats in a different room or a different house. V'mein ein lo bayit acher, and if he doesn't have another house or another room of his own, ochel bebayit chavero, he goes next door to someone else's home. V'mein lo bayit chavero, and if he doesn't have a friend next door, oseh mechitzav ochel, then he can put up a mechitza, a barrier between him and the corpse, and then he can eat. V'im ein lo davar lasot mechitza, and if he hasn't got something to make this barrier, machzir panav ochel, then at least he should turn away from the dead person and eat, right? So we can tell the person that he's not allowed to say the Shema, but he's not on a, you know, he's not fasting until the person is buried. He's got to eat. So in the worst situation where he's got absolutely nowhere to go, all we can say is, according to this statement by the sages, let him turn his back on the deceased person and eat. But preferably, he should go to another room or another house, even if it's next door, someone else's house. Ve'eno meisev ochel, and he doesn't eat in a kind of expansive way, like, Meisev, this is what we do on Pesach. We eat bahaseba, we lean when we eat. They're like eating in a very relaxed and lordly way. He shouldn't do it. He shouldn't eat in that way. Ve'eno ochel basan, he shouldn't eat meat. Ve'eno shote yain, he shouldn't drink wine. Ve'eno bavarech, and he can't say the blessings. He can't say grace after meals, can't say the blessing before the meal. Ve'eno mezamen, and he can't be part of when there's three men benching together, then there's Zimun, Rabot time of Arech, etc. He can't do that. Now, so the fact is that we've been talking about him being in a different room or in a different house to the Met, to the court. And so therefore it seems that all these prohibitions on the Shema and so on apply even if he's not actually in front of the dead person. So, and then it goes on, the Talmud goes on, the Ein Mevarachin Alav. So we don't say, you don't have another person make the blessing on his account. And we don't have this zimun upatur mikriyat shema min atfila, and he cannot say the Shema or the prayer, or minat or wear tefillin, or mikol mitzvot ha'amurot b'Torah, all the mitzvot of the Torah. Of course, he can't do anything forbidden. He can't eat non-kosher food. He can't wear woolen linen together, shabbos. But any positive mitzvah that a person is supposed to get up and do, that mitzvah, make a blessing, pray, or some other kind of mitzvah, he should not be doing it because he has this relationship of kavod hamet, the glory of the dead. Now, then it moves into Shabbat, raising a whole different issue, which we'll come to. I think that it's probably better if we come back to that in a moment. Katani Miha.
Sorry, a
So,
question about what we just read.
yeah.
When we say that he should get up and eat, another in another room or another house if he has it. But for covered a mace, he should stay. If there's no one else by the mace, he has to stay by the mace.
That's a very good point. And it's interesting that it didn't mention that here. There's going to be an account it's going to talk about what happens if you have two people. It's going to talk about what happens if you have two people. One stays with the mace, and the other one goes and says the Shema and prays and does whatever needs to be done. If they are not the close relatives, but they're the guardians. You see, there's another dimension or another configuration where you have a person who's passed away and two people are guarding the body, like Shmira, which we have today. And so the people who are sitting with the dead person, they cannot say the Shema right there, but they can take it in turns. One sits with the dead person, and the other one goes in the other room, and he says the Shema and the Amidah, whatever he needs to say. But neither of them are related to the dead person. However, eating is a different issue, and I think it seems that we want to look after the dead person, but we also want the living person to he needs to eat. And so if he needs to eat, I don't think that the sages want him to fast. He would try to leave the Met briefly and go and eat and then come back quickly, I assume.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you.
So we jumped a little bit, which is talking about what will happen on Shabbat, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But Katani Miha, however, what we learned in this statement from the sages is Patur Mikrit Shema Minatrilin Minatrilin Mikol Mitzvot HaMurot, that the person who is looking after this dead person, even though he's in another room, so the dead person is not right there in front of him, nonetheless, he is not liable, he's exempt from saying the Shema, etc. So then we have two different opinions how to interpret this. Omar Rav Papa says, Tirgama amachas yapaneh v'ochel. When we say that he can't say the Shema or the Amidah or put on tefillin, we're talking about when he's sitting in the same room because he's only got that one room and he can't go in anywhere else, but he's turning his back on the dead person and now he's eating. Since he's in the same room as the dead person, he can't say the Shema. That's Rav Papa's view. Rav Ashi Amar, but Rav Ashi has a different view. Kevin Shemutala Lavlikovro, since he has the responsibility to bury this person, Kumutal Lefan Avdami, it's as if the dead person is in front of him. So, in other words, the person who is responsible for burying the dead, which normally is like the the mourners, the close relatives. It's their first responsibility to make sure their relative, God forbid, that their relative gets buried. So even if they're in a different place or in a different town, they have that responsibility. And so therefore, since since he's got the responsibility to bury him, it's as if he's in front of him. Now, we actually have a very interesting verse about Abraham and Sarah. Shenema, as it says, Vayakam Abraham came to weep for Sarah. Sarah passed away in Kiryat Arba. Abraham, who'd been in Beersheba, came to weep for her. And now he wants to bury her. Venema, so he got up from being next to her. First of all, he was next to her and weeping. Then he got up and he went to look for the people who are in the people he can buy, the people of Hebron from whom he can buy the cave of Machpelah from. So he comes and he says to them, I would like ve'ekbara metim lefanai. I want to bury my dead person in from being in front of me. Now she's not actually in front of him. She's in another room. She's somewhere else in a tent, 100 yards away. Kol zman shemutala lav lekovro, so long that the mourner has the responsibility to bury this person, kumutal lefanav dami, it's as if the person is actually there before him. Now that idea that the dead person is there in a sort of constant sense, I think that that helps us understand the whole halachic dimension here, that there's this sense of a constant awareness of this responsibility, and that therefore he doesn't he is exempt from saying the Shema. Now the Talmud throws in another point, meto in. If it's his relative, his dead relative, yes, all this applies, what we've been talking about. Avon Mashamro, law. But if his whole role is just guarding, he's a shomer for the body, then these things about being exempt from the Shema don't apply. So now the Talmud's way is by making a statement and then making a contrary statement. But haven't we learned in a bright Hamashamet Hamet, someone who is guarding the dead. Now, this isn't a relative, but it's someone guarding the dead. Afo pisha eino meto, even though it's not his relative, patumi kriyat Shema, he is exempt from saying the Shema, minat tefillin, from praying on minat tefillin, and he mustn't put on tefillin, umikol mitzvot hamurot b'Torah, and he's patur from all mitzvot which are said in the Torah. So, Meshamro, so if he's guarding him, Afal pi she'eino meto, even if it's not his relative, he is exempt from the Shema. And meto, and if it is his relative, Afal pi she'eino meshamro, even if he's not guarding him. In other words, one person is in this town, the other one, the dead relative is in this town, and the Onen is in another town altogether. He's not near the dead person, but nonetheless, all these laws apply to him. Now let's go back and consider what happens on Shabbat. This is a bit that we missed out because the Talmud's way is that it assumes that one is able to halt kop, to keep something in one's mind. And so then it comes back to the original discussion. So we've followed through that discussion, and we came to that conclusion that the relative, the onen, who's a relative, all these exemptions apply to him wherever he is, and the guardian of the dead, even if he's not a relative, when he's with the dead person, those exemptions apply to him as well. Now, what happens on Shabbat? Over Shabbat, but on Shabbat, Meisev ochel, he eats in a relaxed way. Meisev, he sits in a relaxed way. Vochel basar, and he eats meat. Vshotei yayin, and he drinks wine. Umavarech, and he says all the blessings, umazamen, and we chant zimun, rabotai, mevar invention, etc. Umavarechin olav, and people say the blessing for him, umazamnin, in other words, including him, umazamnin olav, and they include him in the three, v'chayiv b'chol mitzvot ha'muhot b'torah, and he is liable to all the mitzvot which are there in the Torah. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, then Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel adds, mitoch shenitchayiv be'elu, since he is duty bound in these mitzvot, nitchayiv b'chulam, he's actually duty bound in all mitzvot of the Torah. Now the Talmud is going to ask, what is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel saying? What is he adding? Every word is precious in the teachings of the sages. So we've already heard from the initial statement that we have in this in this writer. That's it didn't it, the Tana Kama, the first Tana, the first author does not his name is not given. Simply the first sage who presents this, and he has made this clear. So what is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel adding? So the Talmud asks this. Va'amar Rabbi Yochanan, my beinai. Rabbi Yochanan says, what's the difference between Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and the other sage? And the other sage, the anonymous sage whose words proceed. Tashmish hamita ika beinayim. Conjugal relations, marital relations is the difference. In other words, the first sage is saying on Shabbat, the mourner is duty bound to keep all the public aspects of Jewish life. He says the Shema and he says the Amidah, he prays, he sits in a normal way, doesn't sit on a low chair. He sits at the table comfortably, eats meat and wine. But something private, like marital relations, he doesn't do. Whereas, according to Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, he also has to, or can, or should fulfill the mitzvah of marital relations. So that's where our piece of Talmud went into that question, and then it came back to the discussion that we were in before. Let's now look at right. Okay, so that is where we got over there. Now we have another case. So we had the person whose own relative has passed away. Then we had someone that it's not his relative who passed away, but he's guarding the body. Now we have a third possibility. Someone is walking through a cemetery. You come to a certain town, you know that your great-grandparents are buried there, and you're walking through the cemetery and you're looking for the grave of your great-great-grandparents, something like that. Meto or Mashamro in. Right. So his relative who's passed away, he's exempt from the Shema. He's guarding the body and it's in front of him. Right. He's exempt from saying the Shema. Abu Mahalech Mabet HaKfarot. But if someone is simply walking through a cemetery, lot, then this doesn't apply to him, and all the general rules of saying the Shema and so on, that applies to him as normal. Ah, wait a minute. V'hotanya, but we have learned in the Braisa, lo yahalech adam b'vet ha'kfarom, a person should not walk in a cemetery utfilin b'rosho, wearing tefillin on his head. It used to be the custom, people would wear tefillin all the time. So if someone is wearing tefillin, they shouldn't go into a cemetery. Or they might be carrying a Sefer Torah. The Sefer Torah b'zvo'o. He shouldn't be carrying a Torah scroll in his arm, b'koreh, and reading the Torah. V'im also, what about if he's reading Torah and he doesn't have a Torah scroll? But the whole idea of learning Torah or visibly holding a Torah. Vim also Kane, and if he does this, if he's wearing tefillin or carrying a Torah scroll, over Mishum is transgressing, lo eglarosh cheref oseu. One who makes fun of the poor man is insulting his creator. The poor man in this case is the person who's in the other world. He's passed away. And it's an interesting concept, but there could have been a whole explication here, but I didn't get around to writing it. That it is only while we're in this physical world that we're able to keep the mitzvah. However glorious the Garden of Eden might be, the world of the souls who have left the world, that is something very special. They're very close to the divine. They get their reward for the mitzvot that they carry down in this world, but they are not able to keep mitzvah. And so therefore, walking into a cemetery wearing tefillin, or more common, which gets mentioned later here, wearing tzitzit, which are revealed. So there's the common practice of wearing tzitzit, which are visible. But when a person goes into a cemetery, they are supposed to hide their tzitzit because the tzitzit are putting to shame the dead, because the dead are not able to keep mitzvah. And so there's this concept, lo egla rosh, making fun of the poor, and there's no one more poor than the dead person in this respect. Cheref oseu is mocking, blasphemes his creator, which is a line in Proverbs. So then the Talmud sorts out this issue. What's the difference about being in a cemetery? Hatam, in that case, where we're talking about going to a cemetery, toch arba amot hud asur, within 4 cubits of a grave, that's where there's this prohibition. But if you're more than 4 cubits away from the grave, chayav, then you have the duty to say the Shema and everything else. The Amamah, because the teacher told us, mate the dead person, tofes arba amot, he fills, as it were, the extension of 4 cubits round him, the Kriyat Shema as regards the Shema, and that's what one is forbidden to do in a cemetery. Hacha, but in a case of someone who's further away, chutzla ba'amot, if he's outside the 4 cubits, he is nami patur, he's also exempt. Now, let's have a look at a parallel passage in the Jerusalem Talmud. Now, this is also from Brachot, the same chapter, chapter 3, from the beginning, which in the Jerusalem Talmud is called Halacha. Halacha 1 is like we would say Mishnah 1. Amar Rabbi Bun said, now he gives a very interesting reason why when one's involved with the dead, one does not have to say the Shema. Ktiv, it's written, Leman tizkoed yom tzeitcha me'eretz Yitzchayim kol yemei chayecha. In order that you should remember the day of your going out of Egypt, all the days of your life. Now, it could have said kol yamecha, all your days. Why does it emphasize the word life by putting in an extra word, kol yemei chayecha, all the days of your life? Yamim sha'ad osek mehen b'chayi, days in which you're involved with living things, that's when you have to remember going out of Egypt and all the other mitzvot of the Torah, and you have to say the Shema and everything else. Yamim, but if it's a day when you're dealing with the dead, then these concepts do not apply. So, in other words, the Jerusalem Talmud has this verse, I think we could have Avram. Would you like to read this, please? This verse.
This verse is about remembering going out of Mitzrayim, which the Talmud understands by implication as regarding saying Shema and doing the other mitzvot. Hence, when one is involved with the dead, one's focus is on that and not, excuse me, Hence, when one is involved with the dead, one focuses on that and one does not carry out the other mitzvot.
Right. Now then we have this commentary. Go on.
The commentary Haredim states that this idea could have been learned from the concept one who is busy with one mitzvah is not liable to perform another mitzvah. So why is this verse needed? For the case of the person who is not actively busy, and this is the answer, I guess, is that right?
Yeah.
For the case of the person who is not actively busy with preparing the dead for burial, but his general mental and emotional concern for burying the dead makes him not liable for the other mitzvah.
Right. So, in other words, the person who is not actively doing something about getting the dead person buried, but it's just waiting to be told when the funeral will be, nonetheless, due to this verse, according to Haredim, which is this commentary, it's a 16th century commentary on the Jerusalem Talmud. His concern is there for the dead, and therefore he's not liable for any other mitzvah. Then the Jerusalem Talmud goes on. Tani, we learn. If the person wants to be more strict with himself, and yes, say the Shema, ain shomim lo, we say, no, I'm sorry, you can't do it. Lama, why? Mipnei kvodo shomei, because of the honor of the dead. Or maybe, mishum she'eino mishi yisa maso'o. Maybe he hasn't got anyone who can pick up the burden. To pick up the burden means being occupied with the burial and all the details needed. So, ma benai, what is the difference between the two approaches, whether it's the honor of the dead or being involved with the actual burial? Hayah lo mi sheyisa maso'o. What happens if he does have someone? So there's someone else who is organizing the burial. If you say the intema mipnei kvodo shel meit, if you say that the main reason is because of the honor of the dead, then he's still forbidden, asur, he's still forbidden to say the Shema, even though someone else is occupied with getting all the details straight and going to the coroner's office. Ve'im tomar mipnei she'eino mi sheyisa maso'o. But if you say the reason why he doesn't say the Shema and so on is because he hasn't got anyone to be occupied on his behalf, hare yesh lo mi sheyisa maso'o. So then if he does have someone, so then you would think he can say the Shema. But in fact, it goes through arguing this way and that in Yerushalmi, and it finally ends with the idea that the main reason why the Onen cannot say the Shema is because of honor for the dead. And we will end with this passage from the Code of Law, the Shulchan Aruch Yoreh Deah. Ophir, would you like to read this, please? The Shulchan Aruch Yoreh Deah, section 341.
The Shulchan Aruch, Doch Sec 341, rules that Onan, who is not involved with the preparations for the burial, is also forbidden to carry out the mitzvah, such as saying the Shema, prayings and blessings. Also relating to another discussion on the page of the Brachot, on the Sabbath, the mourner cannot engage in material relations, even though in other public ways one behaves normally, such as eating meat and drinking wine. One might say that material relations express an external level of homeliness and come from a profound aspect of one's being, turning away from everything else. If one is in the week of the morning, focusing on the departed one, this turning away is not appropriate, even on Shabbat.
Right. And then the Talmud now discusses someone who is guarding the dead. And I think, right. And that's in a. So I think we've we'll stop here, and we're going to be having a vacation, and we meet again, as I said in my email, on the 6th of September, Sunday the 6th of September. So we could just open up if anyone has any final questions or comments. Thank you very much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the
Thank you.
Noon, everybody.
Okay.
Sorry for asking if Rabbi Lu answered earlier when he was looking at his books. I was just wondering what was the answer to Gilgul Neshamot and the raising of the dead at the time of Mashiach. And because the lady, I don't remember the lady's name, I apologize, asked an interesting question. I know Rabbi Lu was going to try and find a good answer.
Oh, yeah.
The books that I took do not include the mentions by Gilgum. It's more about comforting. It's two volumes. It's tremendous wealth in it, but it doesn't have about this question that I could notice. I'm pretty sure that in the Rebbe's Kuntres Tchias HaMeisim, in the work on Tchias HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead, the Rebbe says that each body can rise with that aspect of the neshama that generated the mitzvahs that that body did.
Yeah, that's how I remember it as well.
Did you also say that there's a book called To Live and Live Again that had a good answer?
There's a book, To Live and To Live Again, in English, which is a translation of that whole work. It's fascinating. It was actually translated by Rabbi Dubov.
I don't think I've heard of him. I'll have to look him up.
Is the best or the second best?
He rings a bell. He rings a
Buffy
bell.
is joking. Buffy is.
Am I? Am I? I didn't realize.
Okay. All the best.
God bless. I'm glad you're
Thank you
feeling
very
better,
much, Rabbi
Naftali.
Talman. Wishing you a healthy summer.
Thank you. Refresh Lema.
Amen.
I hope you're
Damata.
feeling better.
And everyone else. Thank
Thank
you.
you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All
Bye.
the
Everyone.
best.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you. Thank you.